Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Carlyle Group First Quarter 2016 Earnings Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Daniel Harris, Head of Investor Relations. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Lauren. Good morning and welcome to Carlyle's First Quarter 2016 Earnings Call. In the room with me on the call today are our Co-Chief Executive Officers, David Rubenstein and Bill Conway, and our Chief Financial Officer, Curt Buser. Earlier this morning, we issued a press release and detailed earnings presentation with our first quarter results, a copy of which is available on the Investor Relations portion of our website. Following our remarks, we will hold a question-and-answer session for analysts and institutional investors. To ensure participation by all of those on the call, please limit yourself to one question and return to the queue for any follow-ups. Please contact Investor Relations following this call with additional questions. This call is being webcast, and a replay will be available on our website. We will refer to certain non-GAAP financial measures during today's call. These measures should not be considered in isolation from or as a substitute for measures prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. We have provided reconciliations of these measures to GAAP in our earnings release. Any forward-looking statements made today do not guarantee future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. These statements are based on current management expectations and involve inherent risks and uncertainties, including those identified in the risk factors section of our annual report on Form 10-K that could cause actual results to differ materially from those indicated. Carlyle assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking statements at any time. With that, let me turn it over to our Co-Chief Executive Officer, David Rubenstein.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning, and thank you for joining our call today. Despite the challenging market backdrop in the first quarter, we deployed a significant amount of capital, produced a reasonable amount of distributable earnings, and positioned ourselves for strong performance in the coming quarters. In fact, our performance and outlook today remains largely consistent with our comments from last quarter, with one notable change. In last quarter's call, we highlighted uncertainty in financial markets, prospects for volatility, and risk tilted to the downside. Today, due in large part to recent pronouncements from the Federal Reserve, equity, credit, and commodity markets have strengthened, and the risk is instead far more balanced. Turning now to the numbers. We continued to invest actively in the first quarter, deploying a total of $3.9 billion. This brings our total deployed capital to almost $8 billion in the last six months and over $11 billion in the last 12 months. We believe that we have deployed capital at the right time, in the right companies and strategies, positioning us well for future earnings. We realized proceeds for our fund investors of approximately $3.2 billion, a little lighter than recent periods, owing largely to a few closings which slipped into the first few days in April. For example, in early April, we exited our remaining stake in RAC, the British equivalent of AAA, for more than 700 million euros and a MOIC all-in of 3.77 times. We raised a gross amount of $2.2 billion in the first quarter. However, approximately half of our previously disclosed hedge fund redemptions were returned to investors during the first quarter, and those outflows countered a majority of our gross inflows. I will discuss fundraising in more detail in a moment, but we continue to see strong investor interest in our funds, and we are excited about the strategies that we have in the market. Pre-tax distributable earnings for the quarter were $129 million, consisting of $51 million in fee-related earnings and $70 million in net realized performance fees. On a trailing 12-month basis, pre-tax DE has been $904 million, and we have generated $2.65 in post-tax DE per unit. Our distribution per common unit this quarter will be $0.26. Overall, carry fund appreciation increased by 1% in the quarter, with solid appreciation for many of our largest buyout and real estate funds and negative performance in certain energy and GMS carry funds. Our fifth U.S. buyout fund and largest cash-carrying producing fund, Carlyle Partners V, appreciated by 4%, and we saw real strength across our U.S. real estate platform, with Carlyle Realty V and VI appreciating by 10% and 6%, respectively. Our natural resources and legacy energy segments were down 2%-3% for the quarter, a somewhat modest decline given challenging energy markets. Our GMS carry funds were down 12%, largely driven by the effect of energy prices on credits in that sector. Turning now to some additional color on our fundraising. we held a final close of our second power fund in April, a $1.5 billion fund that closed above our target and was approximately three times the size of our first fund. We held a final close on Metropolitan's secondary fund at $550 million, exceeding the fund's $450 million target. We held our first close of more than $675 million on our Next Generation Distressed Investing Fund. Importantly, our first close was only slightly less than the size of the entire predecessor fund, so we are confident about our prospects for raising a much larger fund. We continue to make good progress on a variety of existing and new strategies in our global markets business. We did not close any new issue CLOs in the first quarter, but in April we have closed one for about $400 million and we'll likely close at least one and possibly two more in the quarter. And we are working toward our first closes of our new Core Plus Real Estate Fund, our Global Infrastructure Fund, our Fifth Generation Asian Growth Fund, a China Real Estate Fund, and several other funds. We continue to see increased interest in large managed accounts from our most significant LPs. And finally, even though our first quarter fundraising was lighter than normal and several closings slipped into the second quarter, we continue to feel good about the prospect of achieving gross new fundraising commitments of approximately $15 billion for the year. The fundraising environment remains favorable for alternative investment firms, and investors continue to respond positively to our offerings. In sum, notwithstanding a somewhat slower first quarter on certain metrics, our position remains solid, and we are excited about a number of market opportunities. Deployment is up, and our pipeline has accelerated since the middle of the first quarter. Our net accrued carry position remains strong at $1.3 billion. Our public portfolio remains healthy at $15 billion. We continue to launch new products. We have $43 billion in carry fund dry powder and $57 billion in dry powder overall. And we are hitting our fundraising hard caps on virtually all the products we have in the market. With that, let me now turn it over to Bill.
Thank you, David. Last quarter, I spoke of the three C's, credit, China, and crude, that were creating an uncertain investment environment and increasing financial market volatility. Many of these fundamentals remain the same. China's growth, after spectacular performance over the past 35 years, has definitely slowed, partly due to demographics. Crude oil prices, which have rebounded some, are still less than half what they were 2 years ago. And overall credit markets, while stronger today than earlier this year, remain under some pressure, due in part to the negative weight and volume of energy credits. However, our fund heads report that our portfolios are slightly stronger than they were 3 months ago, despite continuing difficulties in growing revenue, particularly in the United States. Much of the improved backdrop derives from the approach taken by the Federal Reserve, which signaled that rates will not rise as quickly as one might have guessed several months ago. That and other factors has contributed to a modest weakening of the dollar, increases in dollar invoice commodity prices like crude oil, improved credit markets, and a stronger near-term outlook for China, whose currency has managed to depreciate on a trade-weighted basis without further declines against the dollar. In any event, public markets, notably the S&P 500, have more than recovered after dropping as much as 11% early in the year. We did not do any significant block trades during the last quarter. However, as markets recovered in April, we sold a $300 million position in NXP and a block of our shares in Spanish testing company Applus. As David mentioned, our investment pace has been very strong in the last 6 months. In the first quarter, we closed 13 new corporate private equity investments, 9 new real estate deals, and several distressed and credit investments. These include Veritas Holdings, a global supplier of information management software, 4 transactions in Europe, Hunkenmüller in the Netherlands, Comdata in Italy, Saverglass in France, and Test Plant Limited in the UK. We closed more than $500 million in energy and real estate investments, most of which was follow-on capital. And we consummated 2 healthcare-related assets in China, one a hospital and another a medical device company, as well as a Japanese bean sprout producer. Last quarter, I mentioned that we had more than $4 billion in transactions in process that had yet to close. In the first quarter, we closed on approximately $3 billion of these transactions, and we remain confident that we will continue to find attractive opportunities to deploy our $43 billion of carry fund dry powder. Looking forward, we believe that the energy sector is particularly compelling. Across the entire capital structure, opportunities for investments are increasing and improving. We have teams totaling 65 investment professionals working to invest our available committed capital for energy of about $12 billion now. On the exit front, we closed on three transactions in the U.S., World Strides, Western Water Holdings, and Landmark Aviation, a deal that generated over three times our money and over $1 billion in distributions for our fund investors. We closed on Taichung Bank in Taiwan and Seven Days Hotels in China. We closed on B&B Hotels in Europe, and we sold more than $800 million in real estate and energy investments. Early in the second quarter, in addition to the block trades in NXP and Aplus, which I mentioned earlier, we closed the sale of our remaining position in the RAC, a CEP3 transaction, which in total, including prior distributions, resulted in gains for our investors of over 1 billion euros. Fundamentally, with few exceptions, we are in the long-term investing business. Despite quarterly market gyrations and shifting short-term investor sentiment, our job is simple: to find great investment opportunities on behalf of our fund investors and aggressively pursue those ideas with our management teams and investment professionals. We take a long view of value creation and continue to see significant opportunities in front of us in almost every geography and asset class. Our investing pipeline is in good shape. Due to strong capital fundraising over the past few years, our funds have ample dry powder, and we are ready to put it to work. With that, let me turn it over to Kurt.
Thank you, Bill. I'm going to make three general comments before discussing specific segment results. First, we continue to focus on managing our cost structure while pursuing new growth initiatives. First quarter cash compensation expense of $162 million was down 6% from a year ago, and I expect cash compensation will remain below 2015 levels for the balance of the year. Even with the lower level of cash compensation over the past year, we have launched or expanded strategies in infrastructure, core plus real estate, and long-dated private equity, among others, which when fully raised could add more than $10 billion in additional assets under management. General and administrative expenses fluctuate based on a number of factors, but primarily due to the amount of external fundraising costs and professional fees. This quarter, G&A expenses were $74 million, or a little lower than our recent quarterly average expense of $78 million. Second, despite financial market volatility during the first quarter, we generated a reasonable level of cash earnings, and second quarter performance fees are off to a good start. Fee-related earnings were strong at $51 million, while realized net performance fees of $70 million were lower than recent prior periods, primarily owing to two factors. First, we took reduced carry in our U.S. buyout fund at about half the rate we would normally take. And second, real estate had a slower quarter of exit activity. That said, a single quarter does not make a trend. Our largest carry-generating funds remain solidly in carry, and our carry fund portfolio has a substantial inventory ripe for monetization. Finally, with the exits that Bill has mentioned, realization of performance fees in the second quarter is off to a good start. Third, fee revenues remain flat but may decrease in the short term. Total fee revenues this quarter increased to $303 million from $287 million in the fourth quarter of last year and were effectively flat with the first quarter of last year. As I said at year end, our 2015 catch-up management fees reflected strong fundraising, and as a result, we had catch-up management fees of $23 million in the first quarter last year, compared to only $5 million in the first quarter of this year. Higher transaction fees offset the lower catch-up management fees this quarter, but transaction fees are not likely to remain at this level for the balance of the year. Accordingly, my expectation for quarterly fee-related earnings in 2016 remains unchanged at about $43 million on average, including the outperformance to that average in the first quarter. Now let's turn to a review of our business segments. corporate private equity produced distributable earnings of $105 million, down from $194 million in the first quarter of 2015, reflecting an approximate $100 million decrease in realized net performance fees as compared to a year ago. Fee-related earnings in corporate private equity were $32 million this quarter, up $10 million from $22 million in the first quarter of 2015, reflecting higher fee revenues. Total expenses in corporate private equity included within fee-related earnings were roughly flat with a year ago. Net realized performance fees were lower than recent quarters as we did not sell any material positions in our public portfolio during the quarter. And as I noted earlier, carry generated from one of our U.S. buyout funds was taken at a reduced rate of about 10% rather than the typical 20% rate. This U.S. buyout fund has performed very well and remains comfortably in carry. However, this fund has some remaining investments marked below cost. While carry is calculated on the entire fund, carry is realized deal by deal. The modeled straight-line average carry realization rate on this fund is somewhat below 20% over its remaining portfolio based on our projections. We have decided to be prudent and reduce the carry realization rate to 10% for most of this year until we have fully reserved for the identified risks in the portfolio and then resume taking carry at a 20% level. It is important to note that this does not change the total amount of carry that we are otherwise entitled to, but rather it simply changes the glide path for carry realization on this fund. Now, turning to global market strategies. Distributable earnings in GMS was $1 million in the quarter. GMS is an important part of our long-term growth strategy, but near-term investments in new credit products and carry funds are delaying the acceleration of profitability for this segment. Specifically, we are adding investment professionals to our credit business within our BDC. We are fundraising larger follow-on funds for our distressed and energy mezzanine carry fund platforms, and we are exploring how to best grow our CLO business. Forthcoming U.S. risk retention rules are increasing capital pressure, especially on smaller issuers of CLOs, thereby creating opportunity for us to further grow. These investments in GMS's future are impacting current segment profitability. For example, fundraising costs in the first quarter of $5 million offset the higher fee revenues from activating fees on our second energy mezzanine fund. In addition, hedge fund assets under management and related fee revenues continued to decline. Hedge fund AUM declined to $6.3 billion from $8.3 billion at year-end, and we expect further hedge fund AUM runoff of approximately $1 to $2 billion over the balance of this year as redeemed assets are sold and returned to investors. Moving to real assets. Real assets produced distributable earnings of $20 million with only $1 million from realized net performance fees, reflecting lower exit activity in the quarter. While a slower first quarter exit pace is normal for our U.S. real estate business, we expect exit activity to increase over the balance of 2016. Fee-related earnings were $16 million as compared to $19 million a year ago, reflecting a decrease in catch-up management fees of $7 million, offset by higher management fees from activating fees on NGP's Fund 11. In Investment Solutions, our financial results started to improve with our decision to wind down DGAM. Distributable earnings were $4 million in the quarter, with over $3 million in fee-related earnings. Fee revenues and fee-earning assets under management in this segment may face additional headwinds in the short term, reflecting the wind-down of DGAM and the runoff at AlpInvest of commitments from its former owners of approximately $10 billion over the next 5 years. However, earnings will likely improve with AlpInvest adding new, higher-yielding assets under management and from the elimination of losses at DGAM. With that, let me turn it back to David for some closing comments.
Thank you, Kirk. Despite the volatility in financial markets in the first quarter, we had a strong quarter in terms of investment activity and a relatively solid quarter on many other metrics. Our second quarter is off to a strong start, and we are well positioned to perform well for the remainder of the year and beyond. With that, let us now take your questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Ken Worthington from J.P. Morgan. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. In terms of energy broadly, to what extent was Carlyle able to take advantage of the brief, but so call it sharp correction in energy values in 1Q? Didn't really see too much on the energy mez side of the existing fund or the new fund. And in terms of energy mez, how does the fundraising outlook continue to look? It didn't look like there was a big close this quarter, but I think expectations are still pretty far above where the fund asset levels are currently. Thank you.
Ken, this is Bill. I'll take the first half, and David will take the second half regarding fundraising. I would say that the sharp upward move was late in the quarter, relatively brief, still from a relatively low level. I think that we were not able to take much advantage of that movement. We still think that that energy prices eventually will go up. This move was such that most people are beginning to realize that prices are going to be a lot lower for longer. And earlier, I think a lot of hope was driving decision making, that people hoped that the markets would start to come back, they could hang on, and then they would benefit from that. There's now becoming far greater realization that that is not what's going to happen. So I think we've got a great pool of dry powder, and we're getting ready to put it to work.
On fundraising, let me put it in context. The first energy mez fund was $1.4 billion. We now have closed in about $2.8 billion with some things that are just about ready to go. So it's about $2.8 billion. We expect we'll be over $3 billion when this fund is completed. So that's a pretty big increase from the previous fund. I was just with the fund head in China last week and meeting with a large investor that will come into the fund. I think investors like the fund for this reason. Some people see it as an energy play. They think energy is coming back, but they like the current yield. This is a fund that provides a quarterly yield that's pretty high, maybe as high as 9%. And so I think the fundraising is in pretty good shape for this. You know, how much higher above $3 billion it will go, I don't know. But that fund will more than double the previous size fund. So I'm feeling pretty good about the fundraising prospects for that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Michael Cyprys from Morgan Stanley. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. Just wondering if you could update us on your progress for building out the longer-dated Global Partners Investment Fund, how much has been raised, and the types of deals you've executed or you're contemplating.
Okay. That fund has closed on about a little more than $2 billion so far. And, I shouldn't say more than two, about more than $3 billion so far. It's one investor put in about $2 billion, and then on top of that, we've raised more than $1 billion more. So we've about a $3.2 billion, I think, is where we are now. We've closed on two transactions. We have two more that are in the works, we feel like we have a pretty good pipeline. We've added a number of investment professionals to it, and we're pretty comfortable that we'll raise some additional capital for it, though we don't need to raise additional capital. We're pretty comfortable that at $3.2 billion or so that we have now, that would be a good amount, but we will probably raise some additional amount of money. And we got a good deal flow right now, and I think we'll, probably by the end of this quarter, I suspect we'll have four deals that are completed.
Great. And could you just elaborate a little bit more on the deals that you've already executed, and then also talk to, some of the broader strategy, what sort of metrics or types of companies you're thinking about within the strategy here and the economics?
Well, there are a couple of the two deals that have been closed so far. The first deal was the purchase of a large portfolio of corporate jet planes and parts leased and owned from a large owner thereof. It was a great deal for us because we're able to use our aerospace expertise that we've built up over the last 25 years, and we're actually able to go through the portfolio plane by plane, lessee by lessee, owner, and some of these are leases, some of them are short-term, long-term, some is outright ownership, and it was a great One Carlyle effort when we put together the people in U.S. buyout and the people in CGP to raise that. to make that investment. The second investment was in a company that we call Content Partners. What it is was the purchase of the residuals on a number of TV shows and movies, things like CSI, for example, where we have bought the residuals and or parts of the residuals in connection with those properties. And both these deals have the advantage of being very long-term assets. You own these residuals, you own them for a long, long time. They pay out on reruns and re-airing and everything that goes on. And the same thing on the portfolio for Corporate Jet Partners, which we've calculated the return such that if we don't do any more leases, we're going to earn a very satisfactory return on that portfolio. But we've now built a platform where we can continue to buy additional corporate jets if we're able to find great opportunities to do that.
Great. Thanks so much.
And our next question comes from Patrick Davitt from Autonomous. Your line is now open.
Good morning. Thank you. You mentioned the portfolio had maybe having trouble growing revenue. Could you kind of walk us through the trends in revenue and EBITDA growth, and maybe more broadly, you know, how you're seeing economic trends both by geography and industry vertical? Thanks.
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say if you look at the data, global GDP measured in dollars was down 5 or 6% in 2015 versus 2014. So that's a part of the dollar being strong, which has a lot of impact, obviously, on U.S. portfolio companies. But the earnings of all the foreign businesses were worth a lot less, and the revenues were worth a lot less as measured in U.S. dollars. And as you know, the U.S. dollar was fairly strong through 2015. That in and of itself, when you are a dollar-based organization, as Carlyle is, although we have funds that are in other currencies, ultimately, by the time you guys look at it, it's all measured in dollars, would lead me to say that our view on revenue growth in the U.S., it's about flat, that there's no significant growth in revenue. Now, we are an investor kind of in the micro as opposed to in the macro. You know, it's a specific deal. How's the deal doing as opposed to how is the economy doing? But in a world where, in dollar terms, the economy is shrinking or is roughly flat, it's very tough for us to do a lot better than that, and we didn't.
And our next question comes from Craig Siegenthaler from Credit Suisse. Your line is now open.
Good morning. Just a big picture question here. So all four businesses have seen a decline in total AUM over the last year. You know, we can see pretty clearly sort of what drove this from the heavy monetizations, lower returns, redemptions. But as we look into the future, can you comment on your ability to grow the overall business from current levels?
Craig, it's Curry. Hey, thanks for the question. So this is a question that we routinely get and received. And so just as in the past, I mean, one of the things that was really good is the amount of distributions that we've had to our limited partners. And just as you said, you know, and that's the opportunity for creating performance fees, but it also puts downward pressure on AUM. As I've mentioned, you know, both before and today, there are just a number of inherent pressures within the portfolio. So, you know, we've talked about the hedge funds and the redemptions there. We've talked about the $10 billion of commitments in AlpInvest and how that will bleed off over time, but be replaced with higher-yielding assets under management, so more profitable AUM, although maybe on lower total AUM. And then also with the legacy Riverstone platform, that too will burn off, and that's about, you know, $5.8 billion that will run off over the next couple of years. So those are just natural kinds of things that will run off. We have a number of funds, as David and we have talked about already, that are in the marketplace that we're raising. That will obviously, you know, create uplift, but you won't probably see the big uplift again until our big buyout funds come back from the market. And quite frankly, with $43 billion of dry powder in our carry funds and $57 billion overall, we're in good shape from a fundraising perspective.
I would add that AUM is not an easy number to grow, but it can be grown if you're willing to take terms that aren't that profitable. And we've been pretty consistent in saying we would like to have AUM that is profitable in the way we manage it. So, we're not adding AUM just for the sake of adding AUM. I do think we will have a fair amount of profitable AUM that we'll be adding because of the funds that we now have in the market and the funds we'll have in the market next year when some of our bigger funds will come in the market.
Thanks for the color.
And our next question comes from Michael Kim from Sandler O'Neill. Your line is now open.
Hey, guys. Good morning. So last quarter, you pointed to, I think, around $4 billion of realized proceeds that were expected to close in the first half of this year. I know you mentioned a couple of block sales and the RIC sale thus far this quarter, but can you maybe just give us a bit more color in terms of where you stand today, including any additions to the pipeline, if you will, and how that might sort of shape the trajectory of realized performance fees going forward?
Sure. Well, let me take a stab at that. The in terms of what has happened already of significant scale, there were two kind of groups so far. First is block trades or position sales totaling about $400 million in between NXP and Applus. Second was the gain on the sale of RAC. The most recent payment, I think, was about $1 billion, I think, 700 million pounds. And so you can work out the mathematics of that. Those were the distributions. Now, distributions don't automatically translate into distributable earnings and the like, but given you know which fund those deals are in, and those funds are certainly the RAC deal is a fund that's in carry. For the balance of the quarter, without predicting specifics what we might do, we do have a $15 billion or $14.5 billion public portfolio. And I think Carlyle has a history of block trades in that portfolio. We like to get our businesses public. Many of them are so big that they aren't suited to be sold in private markets. And when they are sold, we're obviously able to do block trades, and you can see in our release, the names of some of the big positions that we have. It sometimes we call it the ABCs of private equity because we have Exalta, Booz Allen, and CommScope that have been huge winners for us for a long period of time, and still we have enormous gains still to come in those transactions. Not predicting any specific one, but I expect we'll continue to see block sales in the public portfolio. In terms of the private portfolio, we're working on a lot of things. Given the regulatory environment, the difficulty some people have in getting financing, I can't predict when or if they'll close, but we got a pretty good portfolio. Some of it's well aged and we're preparing to sell it, but no, I can't give you any other predictions beyond that.
Got it. That's helpful. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Mike Carrier from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Your line is now open.
All right, thanks a lot. A two-part question. First, just on the real estate business, just wanted to, kind of get some color on maybe the fundamentals there and what, drove the strength, and the performance in the quarter. And then just based on the FRE outlook for the year, it seems like, the trends in CPE and then also in real assets are fairly favorable, including the outlook. I guess when, when we look at GMS and then IS, just wanted to get your take. It sounds like an IS, you're looking at some of the maybe businesses that, the economics aren't as good and restructuring that. Just wanted to get your take if there's more that can be done, on that front in those two segments, to try to maybe improve, the fee-related earnings over time.
Mike, this is Craig. Thanks for the question. So with respect to the first question on the real estate business and what's driving it, so keep in mind that this is an opportunistic portfolio built deal by deal, property by property. We're going in and looking at, pieces of property that we think we can make, a big difference to. And so as we work through that and develop them and get over key risk and milestone issues, the portfolio appreciates. And as you look back, especially on the past year, you'll see the realizations that we've had there and the carry generation that it's created. So even as you backtest the portfolio, its performance has been very good. And so feeling real good about really the way that those portfolios have been constructed. And the other thing I'll note is, CoreSite is a big property in a number of the funds. It's a public portfolio. You can figure it out, but it has done very well, and that also has helped the portfolio. On your second question in terms of the fee-related earnings outlook, so we had a great quarter this quarter in terms of fee-related earnings, but it was contributed to with our transaction fees, primarily on a large transaction that we did in the quarter. And we knew that as we thought about the quarter coming in, and so it was not clearly a surprise, but as we think about the balance of the year, it's hard to say that we're going to have transaction fees at the same level. And it's just as I said last year, I don't think I'm going to have catch-up management fees at the same level. So that revenue is not going to be maybe at the same place. We're doing a lot of things on, both investing in certain places in GMS, but also managing our cost structure. So I do think that there's opportunities for GMS to improve clearly over where it was in the first quarter because we have some additional investments that we've made. And in investment solutions, I think we'll see improvements there as well, really, as I've already talked about with the wind down of DGAM and as the secondaries business at AlphaVest continues to expand.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And our next question comes from Gerald O'Hara from Jefferies. Your line is now open.
Great, thanks for taking my question. A couple quarters ago, you highlighted some changes within the European real estate team. I was wondering if we might be able to get an update as to how things are progressing there, both in terms of kind of raising assets, but also potentially new product development, build out, or just general execution. Thank you.
Well, let me address that if I can. To review for everybody, we have a domestic U.S. real estate business that's opportunistic historically. It's now going into the core plus business as well, and that's going quite well in terms of its new fundraising. We have an Asian real estate business that's now raising a China real estate fund, and that fundraising is going well. In Europe, we are still selling off some of the legacy assets from a prior fund. We have a team that we've recruited and we're adding to. It's overseen by Adam Metz in the U.S., but he has a wide range of experience in international real estate as well. He's overseeing our European team. We expect to be doing something that will give the team some capital to invest, but we're not yet prepared to announce that. But we do think that European real estate is a very attractive area, and we intend to be a participant in the European real estate market.
Great. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Ann Dai from KBW. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my question. I just wanted to focus in on China real estate. I'm just curious what you see as the opportunity set there, how big you think your fund could be within that set, and what type of assets you're focusing on, or maybe what you're not.
Well, this is Bill. What I'd say is, and David can maybe help me out a little bit here, the fund will be consistent with as big as we can make it, as well as we think we can put the money to work effectively. I'd be disappointed if it doesn't get to at least $500 million. It's focused a lot on the consumer, but it also is focused on logistics. We've had a pretty successful run with some logistics properties in China, and I think we'll continue to play some of those angles. The Chinese economy is really changing from being an infrastructure-heavy, manufacturing-heavy, export-driven economy to a far more consumer-oriented economy, and it's a tough transition, although I think the Chinese are making reasonable progress on that, and I think our investing mechanism continues to follow that. As you've read some stories in China about the residential real estate and the shape of that and occupancy rates and the like. We think the best place to invest is consumer-related businesses and businesses that support the consumer.
We also, in addition to the fund we're raising, we do have some managed accounts that are significant that we're investing in China real estate, and we've got a team that's been there for quite some time. So I'd echo what Bill said, that we're pretty bullish in our ability to raise some fund for the team, and we expect to be a significant investor in Chinese real estate for quite some time.
Great. I appreciate the color. The other question I had was around high net worth. So in the past, you've talked about your efforts to penetrate that market. So, could you give us an update on progress in that section?
Yes. Let me try to address that. When we talk about high net worth, I would put it in three categories. High net worth people who have their own family offices. I would say, you know, today everybody wealthy seems to want to have their family office. In the old days, everybody wanted to have their son grow up or their daughter grow up to be president of the United States. Now everybody wants to have their son or daughter have a family office. Everybody wants a family office. And so there are plenty of family offices out there, and you take the wealth around the world. Everybody who seems to have a net worth of about $300 million or more has a family office. And so these people are investing very significantly, as endowments are, in alternative private equity. And so we are working very hard with these family offices and all the family office conferences and so forth, and we've had them for a long time. There's a second category of people who are not quite at that level, but they have, I would say, a net worth of $50 to $100 million, $200 million, and they tend to have their wealth managed by J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. Everybody who's on this call asking questions, your group is no doubt managing high net worth families, and they are probably rounding up them in $1 to $2, $3 million per fund increments, and they pool them together, and that is a very large business for us and other private equity firms. And then you have people who are, I would say, not quite at that level, and they might have a net worth of $25, $50 million. Not that that's not significant, it is, but they tend to have their money managed by firms that never, are not quite maybe J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs or their equivalent, more regional firms. And they are also coming in significantly into private equity. And so in recent months, I've noticed in looking at our statistics that we are our second biggest investor by category is high net worth. Historically, our biggest category was public pension funds, and that is still the biggest. Sovereign wealth funds are catching up to them. But in the last, I'd say the first quarter of 2016 and for the last 12 months, our biggest second category has really been high net worth individuals. And that's in those three categories I mentioned, family offices, pooled by the J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs equivalents, and then by the regional firms. So we continue to see this. And then one other trend that I would mention is it's not just high net worth in the Western world of the United States and I'd say Europe. It is all over the world. Increasingly, the wealth in the emerging markets is winding its way into family offices or the kind of other things I mentioned. And so it's a very important part of our fundraising operation now. Does that more than answer your question or drown you out with more information you wanted?
It does. Thank you. I appreciate the color, and thanks for taking my questions.
Our next question comes from Glenn Schorr from Evercore ISI. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Kaiman Chung for Glenn Schorr. Appreciate the call around the GMS marks and the redemptions. Just that negative 12% carry fund performance, you know, after being down 9-4 in the prior two quarters, kind of bigger than what I thought. Just kind of want to drill down on those performance numbers and what drove it. And then I know you cited the goal for redemptions. Just any sense of timing and what potential offsets we could look towards in that segment. And then the follow-up, if you can, just what's your sense or best guess of when you could turn GMS around? Thanks.
Okay, well, first of all, on the reductions in the GMS carry funds, which were down low double digits, most of that, I'd say virtually all of it, occurred in connection with our energy mezzanine lending business, which, given the fall in the price of crude and other related petroleum products, for example, let's say some proved undeveloped reserves, you know, their value, they may only be valuable when oil is above $50. So in looking at our portfolio, we wanted to mark it down appropriately, and we took large markdowns in that part of the portfolio. That would be the single biggest driver to what was affecting the valuations in the GMS carry funds. In terms of, you know, I guess your question would be about growing the hedge funds. You know, our initial job has been to stabilize the hedge funds as best we can. We have three hedge fund groups. We have the Clarin Road, which is credit hedge funds. We have Emerging Sovereign Group, which is the Emerging Markets Fund. And then we have our Vermilion funds, which are related to commodities. And I'd say that in the Clarin Road funds, the problems there have been pretty well publicized. We received large redemption requests from the investors. We're honoring those on you know, a quarterly basis, giving the investors gradually their money back there. The future of Clarin Road will be determined by its investment performance. And to the extent it's able to have investment performance, it will grow its assets. If it does not, over time, those assets will go away and investors will put their money other places. Same would be true of the commodity funds. And commodity markets have been very tough, as have credit markets so far this year. And we've done well in the metals trades, but less so in many of the other commodity-related products. In emerging markets, they have, you know, great opportunities. We have a fund there that we are seeing some, you know, pretty good performance. It's been tough for actually so far this year. It's been tough performance as emerging markets have struggled, you know, I'm hopeful that that will turn around as we go through the year. I have a tremendous amount of confidence in our fund management of the ESG group.
And Bill, just to add on to that, just a little clarifying on the CMOF 1 mark, just, you know, really that's really driven by the change in the view from a mark-to-market in the credit markets related to energy. And let's just remind everybody that fund is still essentially at one time. So it's still a good fund with good prospects in front of it.
Thank you, Kirk, for making me sound better.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Bill Katz from Citigroup. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. This is Justin Tarrant on the line for Bill. Just one quick question for you, more industry-related. Seeing a lot of peers moving into core and core plus private equity and real estate products. I'm trying to get an understanding of what your views are on that on those as an asset class, and if you have any interest in those kind of moving forward.
Well, in real estate, I'd like to remind people that roughly 95 to 96% of all real estate in the world is so-called core. Opportunistic is really 2 or 3%, and maybe core plus is 1 or 2% if you take all real estate. But in what a lot of the alternative firms have focused on is opportunistic and now core plus. We think that opportunistic will still be a very significant part of our business going forward, and probably for the next couple of years, the most significant part of our real estate business will be opportunistic, which is trying to get, you know, rates of return that are mid-teen or higher. I'd say core plus is a lower rate of return, but probably still double-digit in some respects. And in that business, we are now growing in the United States, and we'll see whether we grow it in other jurisdictions. But we do think there's a lot of demand for it. We expect to have a closing of in this quarter on our first Core Plus fund, and we think it'll be a pretty good size fund. And basically, we've got a very large team in U.S. Real estate, and they are working on both of those funds right now.
Yeah, and with regard to what you referred to as core private equity investing, I don't think we necessarily think of it as core in the sense of like core real estate would be. I think you're probably referring to those long-dated funds that may or may not have a lower internal rate of return, which you know, typically core real estate has a lower rate of return or expected rate of return than does opportunistic real estate. So we don't really think of it as a core product. We think of it as a long-dated fund that you know, our funds just are designed to liquidate much quicker than the core fund, which might have a 15 or 20-year life, would have, as you'd call it, the core real estate fund,
some other
private equity funds.
Some other firms do use the phrase core private equity. It's just not one that we have used. There's nothing wrong with the phrase, but we view our main private equity business as core, and you know, so we just use that terminology, I suppose, in that regard.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Ken Worthington from J.P. Morgan. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thanks for the follow-up. So first, on the restructuring of the investment solutions business, can you flesh out the change in your strategy and maybe how the changes flow through the P&L as we look out for the remainder of the year and maybe into next year? And then maybe higher level, how do you want solutions to kind of fit into your suite of products? I think, for example, there were aspirations for solutions to be a big part of the platform for the retail and the high net worth business. Does that still make sense, or is the focus kind of shifting, you know, more exclusively to the bigger institutional clients like the pensions and endowments? Thanks.
Well, I would say that for a lot of the high net worth individuals, and some people use that as retail, but we would say for high net worth individuals that I referred to earlier, a lot of them would like to have a cross-section of various Carlyle funds including the products that are in our solutions business, and we have ability to do that. And I suspect going to, in the future, we will increasingly say to people that have large managed accounts with us that some part of what they have will be in our solutions offerings. And so I think that's probably how we will do it. Just making available to people a cross-section of things that they could have in Carlisle, some of which will be our solution products.
Ken, this is Kurt. Hey, just adding on to that on the financial aspect. So DGAM was the business that we were winding down, you know, in the funded hedge funds space and also some of the liquid alts products. That business was not running at a profit for us. And so by, you know, winding it down, we're able to stem those losses and thereby improve profitability over the rest of the investment solutions. It will have, you know, you'll see revenue decrease somewhat as that revenue, you know, winds down and goes away. But from a, you know, FRE and DE perspective, as well as ENI, it'll improve over the course of the year.
Okay, thank you. And then maybe for Kurt, repurchase activity was, you know, modest this quarter. I know that's a new program. I guess it maybe even got up and running very late in the quarter. But can you talk about the level of activity this quarter, maybe why it wasn't stronger given some of the price action? Thank you.
Ken, hey, you got it, you know, specifically correct. I mean, you know, we launched the program after our earnings call. We had to wait for our window to open. And so we had, you know, less than a month and a half of activity. The other phenomenon that occurred in the quarter was just the volume of trade in our units dropped, you know, really middle of the quarter. It dropped like by half. As you know, there's limitations on how much you can buy based on average daily trading volume. And so that really kind of constrained kind of what we could do within the quarter. So we bought, you know, 400,000, you know, units back at roughly, you know, a little over $6 million. But that program remains in place and active.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I'm showing no further questions at this time. I would like to turn the call back over to Mr. Daniel Harris for closing remarks.
Thanks, Lauren. And thank you, everyone, on the call today. If you have any further questions, feel free to follow up with me at any time. We look forward to speaking with you again next quarter.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.